We're in Joshua chapter number 10. We're going to start at verse 29. Joshua has just had a great day of victory against the southern allied army of Canaan. Five kings, the head of it being the king of Jerusalem, had decided that they would try to destroy the Gibeonites for making an alliance with the Israelites and take that territory of the Gibeonites into their protective care and use it kind of as a launching point against the Israelites. But with God providing supernatural support, the Israelites just steamrolled over the five-king alliance. They chased them down the Ajalian Valley to the Mediterranean coastline and then southward into the hill country that they came from. And all the way, God is hitting them with stones from the sky, and the Israelis are picking off people in the back of the retreating army. And God even gives Joshua his request for extra daylight in a supernatural fashion. In the end of the day, we've got five kings hiding in the cave at Makkedah. And I think the next day, Joshua brings those kings out, has them all laid down, face down in the dirt, and has the leadership of Israel put their feet on their necks as a symbol of victory by the power of God. And then they execute the five kings and display their bodies on trees nearby. Meanwhile, on that same day, Joshua has the city of Makkedah attacked. Now, they have very few defenders left because most of the people that were warriors that came out of Makkedah in support of the five-king army were killed before they could get back home again. So Makkedah doesn't survive one day's attack, and Joshua executes its leader, its king, and then burns the place down. As the sun is going down on that day, Joshua follows the rules of Deuteronomy, pulls down the dead bodies of the kings, and throws them into the cave of Makkedah where they'd been hiding, has a stone put in front of it, and that's the end of those leaders. But it's not the end of their cities. And so that's the next part of the campaign. And this will take up, I believe, the rest of the campaigning year for this second year of the Israeli life or occupation or being in the land of promise. So we've got this story that starts now in verse 29. Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Makkedah to Libnah and fought against Libnah. So now they come to Libnah, which is probably more well fortified than Makkedah was, but they are still missing a lot of defenders because most of them were in the battle that turned into a rout. He who is gave it also and its king into the hand of Israel. And so he struck it with the edge of the sword and every person in it. He left none remaining in it, and he did to its king as he'd done to the king of Jericho. Now, this will be the new king, the replacement king, the prince who was promoted when his father was killed and thrown into the cave just a day or so earlier. So now we've got a new king, and he's done. And the city is burned. Or actually, the city is not mentioned to be burned here. So verse number 31, Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Libna to Lachish and laid siege to it and fought against it. I've been to Lachish. There wasn't much of it that had been excavated when I was there. I think they've done a whole bunch more now, but I haven't been back to it to see. But it has a very, very strong defensive system around it, a double gate system with the wall. And so it doesn't have a lot of defenders, though, because those have been killed in the most recent rout of the Southern Alliance army. So guess what? He who is gave Lachish into the hand of Israel. He captured it on the second day, and he struck it with the edge of the sword and every person in it, as he had done to Libna. So he's basically just working his way through the cities of the alliance. Horam, king of Gezer, verse 33, came up to help Lachish. Joshua struck him and his people until he had left none remaining. And then Joshua and all Israel with him passed on from Lachish to Eglon. They laid siege to it, fought it. They captured it on that day, struck it with the edge of the sword. He devoted every person in it to the destruction that day, as he'd done to Lachish. And then Joshua and all Israel with him went up to Eglon, to Hebron. Hebron, remember, is where all of the patriarchs and matriarchs are buried. So this would probably be a very special city for Joshua to take control of. They fought against it. They captured it, struck it with the edge of the sword, and its king and its towns and every person in it. He left none remaining. He did to it as he'd done to Eglon. He devoted to destruction and every person in it. Then Joshua and all his Israel with him turned back to Debir, fought against it, captured it with the king and all its towns. Because remember, each one of these cities, a walled city, has associated towns around them. Some of those towns might have walls, but basically, these are city-states. These regions are a self-governing entity. Most of the army had been destroyed in that one day, the miraculous long day. But now this is all cleanup. So they struck them with the edge of the sword, devoted them to destruction, every person. He left none remaining, just as he'd done to Hebron, to Libna, and its king. So he did to Debir and to its king. So by this moment, Joshua has taken out all of the named five cities of the alliance, except Jerusalem. That wasn't mentioned on the list. That will come later. So what he does, now that he's pretty much secured the hill country, with the five cities being knocked out, he now takes that entire southern area that is surrounding the hill country. I'm talking about to the south and to the east from there. So verse 40, Joshua struck the whole land, the hill country, the Negev, that's the southern desert, Beersheba would have been part of that, and the lowland, this is the Shephelah, this is the transition area from the hill country to the coastal plain of the Mediterranean. And this will be the borderland between the hill country and the land of the Philistines. The Philistine territory on the Mediterranean coast, that will be done later. Right now, Joshua is focused only on the region specifically connected to the Southern Alliance. And then they took the slopes, This is a reference, I think, to the area going down toward the Dead Sea and then down toward the little flat area that goes from the Dead Sea down to the Gulf of Aqaba. And they took all their kings. So every little city has its own leader, a king, and he's taking them all. He left none remaining, but devoted to destruction all that breathed, just as he who is God of Israel commanded. So he has basically eradicated all of the Canaanites that have tried to stay and fight in the southern region of Canaan. All of them are now executed. Joshua struck them from Kadesh Barnea. That's the south east corner of Canaan proper. Remember, that was the entry point that they were going to come in on at the very beginning of the story when Moses was leading in the campaign. So it struck them from Kadesh Barnea as far as Gaza over toward the Philistine territory, basically. And so that's actually just describing the swath of South Canaan between those two points. And all the country of Goshen as far as Gibeon. That's not Goshen in Egypt. This is Goshen related to Gibeon. And so Joshua captured all those kings and their land at one time because he who is God of Israel fought for Israel. Then Joshua returned and all Israel with him to the camp at Gilgal. Now, my belief is that what we just read is a description of the campaigning season in the second year that Israel was in the Promised Land. So from March, say, up through August. And the Israelis have now doubled easily the size of their territory in the second year. And they have probably moved some of their people into these regions to allow them to start working the land, to do whatever it is, to harvest what is growing because of the Canaanite agricultural work. And so they're going to be collecting all of that as the year progresses toward harvest time in the fall. And then it'll be non-campaigning season. They don't fight from the fall through late winter. Everybody just takes care of business at home. The season usually degrades into really cold, wet, rainy periods, and it's not conducive to carrying on military operations. And so everybody kind of just agrees to a seasonal truce every single year. And so that's why I believe chapter number 11 is describing what happens at the beginning of year 3 in the Promised Land. Chapter 11, when Yabin, king of Hazor. Now, Hazor is a massive site that you can visit in Israel today. Some of it is has been uncovered. Very impressive what has been uncovered. But it is located midway between the Sea of Galilee and the source of the Jordan. There's several sources, but Dan is where I'm really kind of thinking about right now. And a little bit to the west of that upper Jordan Valley region. There's a wetland there today in that upper Jordan River Valley that's called the Hula Wetland. Back in our story, it's going to be referred to as the Waters of Merom. But Hazor was the head of a northern alliance against the Israelis. So when Yabin, king of Hazor, heard of this, heard of the Israeli victories in the south, he sent to Jobab, king of Madon, and to the king of Shimron, and to the king of Aksaph, and to the kings who were in the northern hill country, that's what we would call Galilee today, and in the Arabah south of Kinnereth. Now, Kinnereth is the Hebrew name for the Sea of Galilee. It's basically harp is what it means. And so the Sea of Galilee is kind of the basic shape of a harp. And so we're talking about the upper Jordan Valley, just south of the Sea of Galilee, where the Jezreel Valley is connected to it, that region right there. And then in the lowland and in Naphoth Dor on the west. So he's basically collecting allies all to the north of the area that Israel has a good, secure foothold in. And the Canaanites in the east and the west, the Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites, the hill country, the Hivites under Hermon in the land of Mizpah. Hermon here is the great big mountain that is north of the waters of Merom, north of where Dan, the city of Dan, is located. And so the Northern Alliance is much larger than the Southern Alliance had been. Verse 4 says, they came out with all their troops, a great horde, in number like the sand that is on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. One of the other things that we know is that in the north, you have the Jezreel Valley, the plain of Megiddo is part of that whole area, very flat. The northern Jordan Valley area is very flat and connects with that Jezreel Valley. You've got passes that go through the ridgeline that is south of the Jezreel Valley down to the coastline in the Mediterranean. That's all pretty flat. And then north of the Sea of Galilee, that's pretty flat as well. So there's a lot of area that is perfect for using chariots in. So there are chariot forces in the north that we did not have in the south. And so that's all here as well. Verse 5, all these kings joined their forces. They came and encamped together at the waters of Merom to fight against Israel. So what we have described here is all of these allied forces from the north are gathering south of the waters of Merom, north of the Sea of Galilee, as a massive encampment getting ready to march southward to take on Israel. Now, more than likely, this is just my guess, their plan was probably to just roll down the Jordan Valley as fast as they could go and slam into the Israelis at Gilgal and try to overwhelm them at their main base with overwhelming force and break the Israeli beachhead at its source. I think that's what they had in mind. But they don't get a chance to carry it out because God tells Joshua to attack them first. verse 6. He who is said to Joshua, do not be afraid of them, for tomorrow at this time I will give over all of them slain to Israel. So this tells me that Joshua has already been alerted by God about the gathering forces in the north, and he has moved the Israeli forces north of the Sea of Galilee, ready to engage the Canaanite Northern Alliance. And tomorrow, it's going to be another rout of the Canaanites because of God. And here's the instructions regarding the chariots. You shall hamstring their horses and burn their chariots with fire. One of the things that we note in God's instructions to the Israelis is that they are never to put their trust in high-tech military stuff, such as horses and chariots. Those are pretty powerful weapons platforms, but the Israelis are supposed to put their trust in God supporting their foot soldiers, their militia. And so they have no use, therefore, for horses and chariots. They can burn the chariots, hamstring the horses, which basically renders them incapable of running. They can still be used for plowing. They can still be used for transport. But they can't be used for military purposes. So that's what they will do once everything is done. So Joshua and all his warriors came suddenly against them by the waters of Merom and fell upon them. And he who is gave them into the hand of Israel, who struck them and chased them as far as great Sidon and Misrephoth Mayim, and eastward as far as the valley of Mizpah. Now, they basically chased them northward. Remember, they start just north of the Sea of Galilee. Then you've got the wetlands that are just north of there called the waters of Merom. So Israel engages them on the south side, I think, of the waters of Merom. The Canaanite alliances immediately panic, because God's putting panic on them, no doubt, and they start retreating northward because there's hills country on the west of them and hill country on the east of them, so they really, the quickest way out is north. And so they run northward as fast as they can go, and then they split, some of them heading west toward the coast of the Med, and others of them heading east up into the foothills of Mount Hermon, trying to escape the pursuit of the Israelis. And we are told that they struck them until he left none remaining. So he just annihilates them. And Joshua did to them just as he who is said to him. He hamstrung their horses and burn their chariots with fire. So he is obedient. Joshua turned back at that time and captured Hazor. So once he'd chased them northward, he turned around, came back south again, at least down to where the waters of Merom were, the wetland of Merom, and then he just goes up a little bit of a hill to the west, and that's Hazor. And he finds the king that apparently retreated there, or maybe he just never left. Maybe he was there when his people were gathering, and he wasn't aware that they were going to be attacked yet. But he's that at Hazor, so he gets killed. For Hazor formerly was the head of all those kingdoms. They struck with the sword all who were in it, devoting them to destruction. There was none left that breathed, So all of that is pretty much a repetition of the procedure we've seen in the other campaigns. And then he did this. He burned Hazor with fire. Now, folks, I want to tell you something. I have been to Hazor, and I have been to the former palace of this guy, the king of Hazor. And when you look in the ruins, there's this fine black line of ash in the ruins. That's this event. It's the ash of Joshua burning it to the ground. And guess what? It's been dated by carbon dating to approximately 1400 BC. Guess what? That is within just a handful of years of what we're talking about right here. I looked at that and took pictures of it, and I want other people to see it whenever I get a chance to take people to Israel and say, you see that? That's Bible proof right there. The Bible doesn't lie. Joshua burned this place to the ground. Verse 12, all the cities of those kings, all their kings, Joshua captured, struck them with the edge of the sword, devoting them to destruction, just as Moses, the servant of He Who Is, had commanded. So basically, as we're closing up for today, he does the same thing here. He is now going to go on a campaign of going around throughout the north to all the different cities and regions that supported this alliance to try to knock out Israel. And he will instead knock them out and take that territory over for the Israelis to then divide up as inheritance in accordance with the Word of God. Mark your place. We'll get back here next time we have opportunity.